Strategic Hot Box with Dr. Brandi Love Stankovic. Discussing leadership, business, and how to take control of your life and achieve greatness. From the streets of Las Vegas, energized, informed, and never diluted, it's time to kick some ass.
Hey, it's your girl, Dr. Brandi Stankovic, and you are here on the Strategic Hot Box with me. And it is an episode called Winning. Yeah, it's about to happen. It's all about the win-win. And we are going to talk to our subject matter expert, Jeremy Roadruck, here in just a second. Check it out. So as you know, on the Strategic Hot Box, we learn, we love, and we kick some ass. In the learn section today, we're going to talk about win-win. What does that mean? Why the philosophy? How is it relevant today? In the love section, we're going to talk to Jeremy and hear about his expertise. And he is a real life ninja. If only my boys were here, they would love it. And in the kick ass section, we're going to give you some tools that you can start implementing right now. So whether you're driving, you're in the gym, you're at your computer, if you're watching or listening, you can start implementing these tools today, right now. All right. So when it comes to win-win, we've all heard that concept of the idea that creating a solution where all people can have a benefit in the outcome. And Stephen Covey, my boy, Stephen Covey, came up with it way back in the day in talking about this idea that it doesn't have to be the zero-sum game of I win, you lose, or you win, I lose. Just kidding. I never lose. It wouldn't be that way around. No, but this idea of a zero-sum game of the one person being clear and the other person it going the other way around. And so I think that the idea that there being mutual benefit of all parties involved is an important kind of concept to think about and a balance of that. Now, I also think that there's a challenge of this idea or concept in the win-win front in the idea of everybody gets a trophy. We're in this generation of people where everyone gets a participation trophy. Now, for those of you that have children or have been around children or were a child once in your life, I'm sure you've thought about the concept of the participation trophy. And I'm actually, I go back and forth on this idea. I don't think it's appropriate for us to reward mediocre behavior by all. Right? On the flip side to that, I'm thankful and happy that the referees don't keep score, excuse me, on my kids' basketball and soccer games, because I think that in general, first, the kids keep score on by themselves mentally anyway, and secondly, all it does is create a heightened level of feeling of excuse me. A feeling of insecurity or a feeling of loss or a feeling of I'm not good enough in very young children. And now there needs to be growth. There needs to be challenge. There needs to be those kinds of things. And don't you worry, we're having those conversations at home. But when you put that up in such a visible way with kids that are in growth and learning mode, it becomes a really intimidating environment. So I like the idea of there not being a score, but you're still going out there and being competitive and playing a teammate and that type of thing. So I think that there's somewhere a balance between it creating a win-win or a mutual benefit environment and not necessarily celebrating mediocrity, right? So there has to be somewhere in the middle. Our personal focus and in our household is it's not all about winning, but we didn't come here to lose. Right. And so we say that every day before the kids go into their games, in the fact that it's not all about winning. It's about your own growth, your own working hard, your own getting better at what you're doing. But hey, at the end of the day, you did not show up here to lose today. And so it's about doing the best that they can possibly do. And one of the books that comes to mind for me, beyond, of course, Stephen Covey and the Seven Habits, is Whale Done by Ken Blanchard. I don't know if any of you listening or watching have read that book, Whale Done. But it talks about positive reinforcement and a redirection can help increase productivity. And it tells the story of how when people train killer whales, right? So, and it's the idea that you can't, you know, the concept of carrot and the stick, right? So you give people benefit or carrot incentive to do something, and then they hopefully will do more of it. Or you can give them the stick, which means, you know, negative reinforcement of saying, no, bad person, and they'll do less of bad behaviors. Well, with a killer whale, you can't give them the stick. What are you going to do? Say, bad killer whale, they'll eat you. right? And so what they have learned in training killer whales is it has to be entirely around positive reinforcement. And there's something to that. And so this Whale Done book is all about how positive reinforcement can really build teams and build cultures. And one of the things that I pulled from that I really absolutely love is the idea of catching people doing things right. Instead of catching people doing things wrong, catch people doing things right. And so often I'll get in conversations with my colleagues or CEOs, and they'll say they'll have discovered something in the analytics. They'll get a report and find out one of their employees was doing this, or find out their team was doing that. And oh, I cannot believe I just found out the team, their numbers are at this. And I think and I always give the advice of, hey, go into the meeting and don't let them know that you've gotten this report. Go into the meeting and say, here's the tools that we have and the resources we have to help you do your job. Here's the results and outcomes that I expect for you in this job. Now, over the next month, I want you to do the best darn job you can possibly do. And in the month, I'm going to come back with some analytics, and we're going to talk about what happened. And then give them the chance to do something right. Because when you catch people off guard, or you catch them doing things wrong, people can feel violated by that. And so I think that giving people the chance to turn their lives around, giving people the chance to do things right feels good as a culture feels good by individuals. And so I love that concept. And I think that really is part of this win-win idea of creating this mutual benefit. And so I like the concept, but it really is creating a balance of making sure it's a competitive environment and not celebrating things that aren't achieving. Because if we give everyone a participation, like, you're good, you're just going to get an annual raise just because we give everyone annual raises, that doesn't help anybody. Because we want, as an organization, we're just going to put ourselves out of business. If we're not growing and selling, then if giving people raises every year, you're ultimately just going to shrink the margins that you have to work within. We've got to be able to grow together as an organization, as leaders, as people. So let's talk to our subject matter expert. And he has a really great perspective in his work with people and with little tiny, you know, humans, little kids, and people from all over the country. And he talks about children having an innate ability to seek the win-win. And I look forward to hearing his concept. So let's formally introduce Jeremy Roadruck. He is a Kung Fu master and a Pan American champion. He's also a best-selling author and speaker and consultant. And he's a Tony Robbins Master University graduate. So please join me in welcoming Jeremy. Hello there.
Hello. It's great to be here. Thank you for having me.
Do you introduce yourself to young kids as a real-life ninja?
No, that would be a different system of training. I would be more like a warrior monk.
Ooh, a warrior. I think my kids would be all over that. I love it. So tell us about your journey.
Well, I had kind of a rough childhood. I switched gears at about 6 years old, and because I said so, stopped working with me at six.
Whoa.
And so it made it challenging for a lot of the adults around me to get influence or to direct me or to guide me. Because I know you're not going to kill me, so you can shut up. But I was smart enough not to be that obvious about it. So I became very manipulative and was really just not in a happy place for a very long time. And so about 26, well, I started martial arts at 20. And about 26, I kind of had some realizations. And it led me to expanding and realizing what I had been doing. And I had been playing a bunch of unconscious games between me and the world around me. Number one was, I have to survive. And for me, from a very young age, everything was about survival. So imagine playing tic-tac-toe with a seven-year-old who thinks, if I lose, I will die. Wow. They bring a little bit of intensity to the game, say the least. And so that energy pushed people away. And so I had to start backing off of my energy, calming down, relaxing, trying to figure out why were things going the way they were going and what could I do different. Mm-hmm. And that led me to a lot of different explorations of cultures at a very young age, getting into and out of what we would call risky behavior, what I call adult behavior in pre-adult people.
Mm-hmm.
And I ended up starting martial arts when I was 20, and it was something that I had paid for. I took a best friend with me, and we went and checked out all the local schools where I lived, which is Dayton, Ohio, and we found one school where the instructor, Grandmaster Ming, he kind of challenged us to, I've been doing this my whole life, try and prove it wrong. And it was a great vehicle for me to get my body, my mind, and my emotions and my social skills to start working together. Because you can be intellectually dominant, but when everybody in the room can kick your butt, it's really fast.
No doubt about it. I love that. Mm-hmm.
And so within about 3 months of starting lessons, I was assisting with classes. I was there 7 days a week. I was working in a sandpaper factory, and I wasn't super happy with where my life was going. And the martial arts became a tool to really work on myself on the inside and then bring that back out on the outside. And in fact, the third month into training, I started in March. In May, the Grand Master of our particular family had come to town to do a workshop. Couldn't make the workshop because I was working that day. But I went out for social time afterwards, and we were at a pool hall, and we were playing pool. And Grandmaster Ming heard me say something about myself to myself out loud that was derogatory. Mm-hmm. And he stopped what he was doing, and he looked me in the eye, and he said, "Hey, don't talk to yourself like that." And then he went back to playing pool. And I know my parents had told me the same thing in different ways, but who he was, how he said it, the way he caught my attention, it clicked for me. Mm-hmm. And I started paying attention to how I talked to myself, how I conducted myself. And the sandpaper factory gave me a great place to kind of reflect. Didn't require a lot of thinking because a lot of repetitive work. Mm-hmm. It allowed me to really start working on integrating and figuring out, you know, I am a jerk to myself. Imagine that. So why am I, you know, a jerk to everybody else? It starts inside and it rolls out. Mm-hmm. And so then I began to start, like, what I call today is playing different games. I started sending out different energy and people would respond to that. When I smiled at them first, they smiled back. When I made a joke, they laughed and they wanted to be around me more. Hmm. Interesting stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so how do you define the win-win then? Is it that? Is creating positive behavior then brings positive behavior?
Yeah. So the idea of the win-win for me is really it's an energy exchange, mm-hmm. right? Can I help you to feel warm, big, and happy on the inside? And how can you, through our exchange, help me to feel warm, big, and happy? Because, like, when I'm coaching parents, you know, your kid is going to get energy from you, good, bad, or sideways. They don't care the quality of the energy. They need quantity first. Mm. And so if they can't get it through love and appreciation and connection, then they will force it through argument, misbehavior, running away, right? Why do two-year-olds run away? Because I get picked up, more energy. But if you're constantly, I love how you're standing there. Can you give me a high five? Wait, are you still there listening and being a good example? That's so awesome. I love you. You're amazing. And if you keep catching them like that every couple of seconds, every couple of minutes, they're going to stay closer to you to get those rewards versus running away from you to get more energy, to get your attention. Mm-hmm. So it's that idea for the game. How can I help you? And then how can that flow back to me? So it's like the Bob Berg book of Giver's Gain, right? Mm-hmm. Or the Go-Giver. It's the idea that you send the energy out because nature hates a vacuum. Once you send it out, it flows back from somewhere. Maybe this person, maybe another person. But the energy's there. You just got to get it going.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And you're right about kids. They do, and we do bounce. They do take it from you regardless of what that energy is. And so sometimes it's not conscious as parents, how our stress can trickle into their little bodies too.
Absolutely. And when they're younger, this is a difficulty that little kids have is they don't know how to disassociate their thoughts, their feelings, their actions from you. Mm-hmm. So if you're irritated, frustrated with yourself and your inability to motivate them, connect to them. Maybe you have something going on with work. You got a letter, an email, a phone call. You're frustrated and that energy is being expressed. The little kids think that's my fault. I did that. Mm-hmm. And they don't think I did something bad. They think I am bad. Mm-hmm. And that begins to influence their identity. And that leads to how they show up and how they behave and how that rolls forward. So we have to be very clear, you know what, babe, I love you, I'm frustrated, there's something else going on, nothing to do with you, so mommy's going to go, daddy's going to go, I'm going to be in timeout for 5 minutes, just let me deal with this, and then I can come back and be 100%. Is that okay with you? Mm-hmm. And that way I'm creating a dialogue with my kids to identify our feelings mm-hmm. separate from our actions, mm-hmm. and our relationship is something unique between the three of us. And so, you know, between the two of us, between our thoughts, our feelings, our actions. And so we can separate that out and the kids can begin to see, I did this thing, I can change what I did, mm-hmm. versus mommy, daddy has something else going on that's not about me. And that way the kids can kind of relax and be calmer because they're not so stressed, mm-hmm. right? We're mad at ourselves. They don't know that because they think that we know what they know and they think they know what we know.
Right.
And that there's actually some developmental milestones along the way for that.
No, absolutely. And I was just literally just going to say that. And you can see how they progress as children and what they when they begin to see some of that awareness. But I was also thinking about the parent timeout and laughing to myself. Whenever I have to go to a kid's party, I don't know if you, like, you do this for a living, so you probably have much more tolerance than I, but whenever I have to go to a kid's party, usually by the end, I'm exhausted. It's like the longest 2 hours around screaming children ever. And so I get home and I need 5 minutes, typically, is what I'll say. Mommy just needs 5 minutes. You know what does that mean? I'm going to start calling it a mommy timeout, which I think is just a beautiful term. But just give me 5 minutes. And so sometimes we'll get home and the kids will go, do you need 5 minutes? Would you like me to close your door? I'm like, does that mean I look stressed? But yeah, I'll take it. But we kind of giggle about it. But back to the time frame, kind of the progression. My older child is 8 years old now. And the other day I came home and I had talked to my husband on the phone, and he said when I walked in, he goes, I could hear your voice on the phone with daddy and I could tell something was wrong. Is something wrong? And I looked at him and I was like, wow, like that this is a new place that his brain is at to be able to say, one, I discerned that your voice is not normal. And two, to be able to say, hey, something's up, you know, tell me about it. And I love that they're, you know, they're growing as little human beings.
Yeah. 8, 9 is kind of like, is like one of my favorite ages because they have that youthful innocence. They haven't turned into teenagers yet typically, but they have that youthful innocence, but they also have the awareness. And the word I would use with the kids is you have the perspicacity. They start to notice things on a higher level and they're so much more competent and capable.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, dude, you're awesome. I love that. Mm-hmm. And then they start to switch. Between 10 and 12, the peer group begins to have influence.
Yeah.
And then you go through a new phase of life that's a very interesting place. It's not my favorite, but it opens the door to some really powerful conversations because your kids will start deconstructing, you know, here's what our family values are, but here's what I see my friends doing. Mm. And you'll see them start to process that. And if you've got open dialogue with them, they'll share that process with you and those realizations. And it's just amazing to watch how they start to architect their views of the world and their value system as they go forward.
Mm-hmm.
And you have a real powerful opportunity if you're an influential parent to help put some things in place and armor your kids that they can make intelligent choices on their own. They don't need you to hold their hand.
Right.
The challenge is for positional parents, shut up, do it because I said so and I don't have time. They tend to go into a lot of pain.
Yeah.
At 10 to 12, because their influence is dropping to zero because the kid's getting more freedom, more away from the house, more larger social circle, more opportunities to get away from mom and dad. And so when you're a positional parent, that tends to lead to a lot of pain, where an influential parent, at least a lot of joy and a lot of amazingness.
I love it. So are kids any different than leaders?
Kids respond. And they can be leaders and they can be followers. The way I break it down is I basically go like this.
Mm-hmm.
And there's three kinds of people. There's leaders, there's followers, and there's loners. And the leaders, they pull. So you want to ask, you know, look at your kids. Are they pulling a direction? Whenever I tell my parents, you know, how do I push my kid? Oh, that kid's in charge, not the parents.
Mm-hmm.
Because leaders pull, they don't push. Followers push.
Mm-hmm.
So if you as a parent are pushing your kids towards something, that means you need to increase your vision, increase your rapport, increase your influence.
Mm-hmm.
But good followers push forward. They're going to add energy to the conversation. Bad followers push backwards. So then you can look at the dynamics of what you've got. You know, my daughter is 4.5 and she has those leadership moments where she's like, let's do this. And she'll start to influence the people around her. But then sometimes she wants to be a follower and we're going to play a game. You want to play a game? Sure. And then we'll go and we'll do another game and she'll play along.
Mm-hmm.
And then that third group, the loners, those are just people that haven't found their team yet. They don't have anybody to push them or pull them. And especially when I work with high school students, you know, a lot of loners in high school, it's because they're leaders. They just haven't found their tribe.
Mm-hmm.
They haven't found that group that they click with yet. And that's going to happen when you get out of high school and get into the larger world. Just give it time.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's that influence, that building those games. That allows you to start looking at when I'm talking to a group of leaders, whatever their age, I start looking at the games they're playing. Are they pushing? Are they pulling? Are they trying to get everyone to win? Or are they trying to make sure that they win and they don't really care about what everyone else gets?
So when it comes to the positive games and the stories and the tools that you use to create camaraderie, how can people implement or start using some of that strategy?
It begins with one of your fundamentals is, and you kind of said it already, right, about winning and losing. No, I never lose. I learn. Mm-hmm. Because I either win or I learn. There's no such thing as losing. Losing means I gave up and I went home and I quit. As long as I'm still in the field of whatever, you know, field of competition, field of battle, field of business, field of education, whatever field I'm in, I might be getting D's right now, but I'm learning what not to do so that as I go forward, I can start eliminating those things and go find the things that work. So that win or learn, when you don't get your result, great. What did I learn not to do again? Mm-hmm. How can I implement that? How can I share that with other people so they don't waste time making the same mistakes? If you share your mistakes so that I don't copy them, and I share my mistakes so you don't copy them, we both get smarter, we both get more capable faster. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of the same idea with your team, as with your family, as with your staff. Whoever you've got, you can be open about your honest, I overshot this, I overspent this. Mm-hmm. You know, how many people on the Forbes 400 list have filed bankruptcy? Mm-hmm. Good, they know what it means to try too hard or to reach too far, and they recovered, and they can share some wisdom. Fantastic. So you either win or you learn. Which one is it? What are we learning right now? And when you start to change it that way, it takes people out of reactionary mode where it's like, oh, I'm stupid and I'm worthless and I'm never going to get this. And they can begin to start being more proactive and going, well, this probably wasn't a good idea. Oh, yeah, yeah. And then because of that, I thought about this and then that wasn't so great. But what if I did it this way? That might be awesome. And so that way you get people to get out of a reaction and get proactive instead, start finding solutions.
You know, sometimes in the mistakes, and you were describing in your difficult childhood, in the times where I've fallen down, or in those moments of loss, whatever that looks like for anybody's experience, that's when the greatest growth happens for people. And if we protect people from that, are we robbing them of their own growth? And does entitlement come from that? I mean, how do you balance this this change of framework where it's not losing, it's learning, which I absolutely believe in, but not to be careful not to create entitlement and protection?
Well, the other part of it is, you know, you mentioned earlier about the participation trophies. Hey, I love the fact you're not on the couch, you're not playing Fortnite, you're not on the video games, you're here doing the thing with us. We want to recognize that. And how are you going above and beyond the minimum? Mm-hmm. Because you do the minimum effort, you get the minimum reward, but you do more, you're going to get back more. Mm-hmm. And so we want to create a conversation around yes and, or both and. Uh-huh. So that we're expanding and not be afraid of pain, because pain is not a bad thing. Pain is instructive at times. And the question to ask, especially with kids and teenagers who are struggling, people that are in career transition, what if the beginning of a breakdown was the start of a breakthrough? The old order has to fall apart for the new thing to begin. So what if the old stuff got you here, but for the next level, you have to change, you have to grow, you have to shift? And if we ask that question and leave it open, then the brain can start to work on the head, the heart. You can begin to work on the answer to that question versus what's wrong with me? Why can't I figure this out? Why do I make these stupid choices? Because your brain will go work on those questions too. Mm-hmm. So like whenever I see someone struggling, I don't ask what's wrong. Or when I have a kid fall down, hit the ground, I don't say what's wrong. I say what happened. Mm. Or I say, where's the blood? Because, you know, I got to make sure there's no blood.
Right,
no,
yeah, right. Do I need to call an ambulance? Right.
Right.
Wow, that's that. I think that it's an important piece of all of the growth and the age and being with people at any level of their advancement and growth, and it is an important part of their lives, and the impact we can make on people in different places that we touch them is so powerful. Can you share a funny story?
Funny story. Well, when I was 4, this is the kind of kid I was, because when I have parents come in and I ask them, you know, what can I help you with? Most of the time it falls into either self-discipline or it's confidence. It's one of the two. And I was like, well, you know, oh, my kid has so much energy. They don't listen. They don't this, that, and the other. Well, have you put him on a leash? Well, no, how dare you? I'm like, no, please understand. When I was 4, I was raised on a leash because I used to run into traffic and my mom pulled me out. And so we lived in Turkey, I climbed on the roof of the house using the fig tree in the backyard, and I climbed over the edge of the roof, and I looked down, and I said, "Hi, Dad." And my dad looks around, he looks under the car, doesn't see me anywhere, goes back to working on the car. I gave him a couple of minutes, then I looked down and went, "Hi, Dad." And he looks around, he's looking in the car, he's like opening the doors underneath, walks through the whole garage, really confused, goes back to working on the car. The third time I said, "Hi, Dad," he looks up and flips. And this was Turkey in the 1970s, and so getting a ladder wasn't so easy. So they run around the back of the house. The tree's too small for my parents to climb safely. So my 8-year-old brother has to come get me. He's scared of heights, so he can't climb it. So I'm on the edge of the tree in the roof telling him where to put his hands so he can climb up, because in my brain, as long as I'm on the roof and they can't get me, I'm free and clear. But if somebody from down there comes up here, then I have to go back down.
Oh my gosh.
He managed, after about 20 minutes of me telling him what to do, to get up and get me, and then we went back down. And I don't remember the rest of that day, but I remember I probably got in trouble for that.
But there was no blood, no ambulances.
No blood, no ambulance.
Oh my goodness.
But I use that with parents because they're like, you know, I'm like, look, I'm an international best-selling author. I'm a Kung Fu master. I'm a Pan American champion. Just because your kid is high energy doesn't mean there's anything wrong with them. You just got to learn how to work with that person and make adjustments. Mm-hmm. And not think one size fits all. You know, if you have more than one kid, they're different. So you got to adapt. You got to play this game with them and play different games. My brother is content to watch the grass grow. Mm-hmm. I can sit still for about 6 or 7 minutes, and then I got to get like up and do stuff, because right. We just have different energy levels. Mm-hmm. No harm, no foul. Just own it.
Right. And I think that that's an important lesson too, as far as parents not giving up. We're so exhausted these days. We're so busy that parents tend to give up on, well, this child isn't going to be this, or he's never going to grow to this, or she's never going to blossom into this.
Oh, yeah. And... Well, when I work with school systems and I work with teachers, I don't have problem kids. I have what I call leading edge kids, which are usually ladies and gentlemen who are a little bit ahead of their peer group, sometimes a lot, and they're bored. Mm-hmm. And let's be honest, your teaching is boring. Mm-hmm. So how can you engage them? How can you get them on your team? How can they become an asset to you? Yeah. And I've had some teachers who began to engage with the kids as like kind of junior teachers and began to leverage they can get through the things quick. They understand it. Great. Can you help Billy? Can you help Sally? And when you get them to start helping other students, their self-respect goes up. Their standards for their classmates and themselves goes up, and they suddenly start helping to kind of police what's going on. Right. You can do the same thing with older siblings and younger siblings, although sometimes it's the younger siblings that are helping the older siblings.
What's a one-word takeaway for our listeners today? One or two words?
Influence.
That's great.
Right? Everything you're doing as a leader, everything you're doing as a parent, it's about how much influence you have. And when you're in a place of positional authority, you have no influence. You know, you can use the carrot, you can use the stick, but when you leave, there's no nothing going on. So we want to get to intrinsic behavior, intrinsic reward. You reward yourself. I got to influence you so that I understand your identity, I understand your vision and where you want to go. Connect those two together, because then you begin to influence yourself and get yourself to the goals you want, and I don't have to hold your hand. A real leader should be producing more leaders, not followers.
Thank you very much. And how can people get a hold of you?
Best thing is to go actually to facebook.com/JeremyR.TheKungFuGuy. And that's the best place to get a hold of me.
Well, thank you so much for being a part of the Hot Box today. I loved it. And hopefully we talk to you again soon.
Absolutely. Thank you. You are awesome, and keep up the good work.
Thank you, Jeremy. Let's head out to the shout out.
Soy Pablo Cornejo de Argentina y acabo de hacer un tour en bicicleta con Grasshopper Adventures en Bangkok. Está buenísimo, así que estoy muy contento de aparecer acá en Strategic Hotbox. Un abrazo, un saludo.
Gracias, Pablo, for the shout out. Thank you so much for the shout out from Argentina. We appreciate it. And thank you again to Jeremy. Here is our top five kick ass for the win-win. Number one, and one of my most important philosophies, and I know that you've heard it from me before, is to create a loving environment. Making sure that if we are going to, as humans, be able to work together, be able to have an environment that fosters that. Number two is don't keep score in learning. So as children are progressing, as leaders are growing, to not keep score while they're learning in that process. But eventually we're going to have to be able to keep metrics so we can grow beyond that, but not keep score in learning. Number three is catch people doing things right and appreciate the things that they're doing. Is the example that Jeremy gave of telling children when they are there, giving them the energy that they deserve when they're there, being good, catching leaders in your offices when they have the chance to utilize the resources that they need. Number four is to showcase integrity. When someone is living the values and living the system and aligning with your organizational values, showcase that integrity. And number five is to tell stories, play, have fun, celebrate, enjoy life, and make it a win-win. There's your top five, kick ass. Thank you again to Jeremy and Pablo and all of you for listening to us here on the Strategic Hot Box. If you have any ideas for us, hit us up Instagram, Twitter, or on our website. Until I see you again, get out there and kick some ass.